This is my first thought. I'm in Ottawa, working on a project that allows me to improvise with a wonderful dancer, trying not to second-guess myself, so I'm thinking about first thoughts in a number of ways. One of my best first thoughts of late was at 5 a.m. in Amsterdam 3 weeks ago, when I recorded these birds that woke me most mornings as they sang outside my window. I'm pretty sure they're improvising. On Saturday, I turned 50, and I went for a swim at the Champagne Community Pool. I swam thinking about being 50 and how our definition of old changes. In the next lane, I saw a man in his late 70s. Now he's old, I thought. Later in the shower, I saw him again, this time naked. He had a tattooed garland of butterflies going around his ass and hips and groin. I'm not a big tattoo fan, but this was beautiful. I looked at him and I thought, I wonder how often he remembers those butterflies. Today in rehearsal, we were combining material that I made with material made by the dancer I'm working with, and I was reminded of how one must find the tricky balance between staying true to your material and allowing the other to affect you. In that effect is the conflict, the reason, the magic tension of it all. Sergei Eisenstein said, "Montage is conflict, the collision of two given factors from which arises a concept," to which I add, "You must neither crumple on collision, nor must you drive away undamaged." Today in rehearsal, the director cited Gödel's theorem, which states that no axiomatic system can be both consistent and complete. Gödel was talking about mathematic theory, but I do find it useful to consider in what way this might apply to our work making a new performance. Its value to me today was in the reminder of the perils of completeness and consistency, even as we must, to some degree, strive for both, trying to find the edges and rules of this world we're making, looking for what feels right while trying to allow ourselves to be wrong. I feel like every day in rehearsal, I am reminded of Declan Donlan's assertion that as an actor, you get into trouble when you concentrate rather than paying attention, that concentration destroys attention. Today, I was thinking how my attention should be feathery or porous at the edges. Daniel, the director, explains how there are things we can see with our peripheral vision, stars in the night sky, for instance, that we cannot see or cannot see as well when looking directly at them. Another way of saying this is that you should not go bird watching expecting to see a particular bird. Today, 2 weeks into rehearsal, we put together three pieces of material: physical scores made by the dancer and I, based upon our own memories, and the text, some details of a play by Euripides. And it all fit together in that way that can seem almost miraculous, predestined, and singing with significance. And then in a sort of ripple effect, other things started to make a new sense. It makes me think of Annie Dillard's description in her book Pilgrim at Tinker Creek of looking for muskrats. She looked for months and never saw one, and then suddenly she could see them everywhere, all the time. Tonight I arrived on the farm in PEI where I grew up. My first time back here since my mother died a year and a half ago. She died in her room in the farmhouse, in the bed that belonged to her grandparents, with my older sister and I on either side of her. I'm standing now in the farmyard between the house and the barn. The ancient Greeks apparently believed that vision was the result of rays emitted from our eyes that brought the seen object into sight. Right now I feel the opposite, as if the frogs in the distance, and the many, many stars more distant still, and the barn, and the house across the yard, are all seeing me, and patiently and gently bringing me back into existence. I'm here on the farm with my younger sister and her son, who's 16 months old. Right now they're sleeping in that same bed, the bed my mother died in, the one owned by my great-grandparents. Walter Benjamin said, "There used to be no house, hardly a room in which someone had not died. And I'm standing near the spot in the farmyard where, on a snowy winter night when I was 15, I midwifed the birth of a lamb that had been stuck, head out. I remember the feeling of the mother sheep's contractions against my forearms as I pulled that lamb slowly out into the world. I thought my arms would break, but they didn't. This afternoon, I listened to a CBC Ideas program about torture called Unspeakable Acts, with excerpts from an interview with Elaine Scarry, the author of a book called The Body in Pain. In the introduction to her book, Scarry apparently says, "This book is about the way other people become visible to us, or cease to be visible to us." It sounds like a joke, but I was struck by the strange parallels between the intent of the torturer and that of the artist. Certainly both are deeply invested in the sensory experience of their victim. Scarry says that one objective of the torturer is to create an experience that defies language, that the torturer seeks to make the tortured one relinquish their world. In that sense, the torturer is forcing the victim to be absolutely present, which is also the goal of at least some of us who make theater. In the project I just worked on in Ottawa, I proposed some text from Anne Carson's translation of Euripides' play, Heracles. "Here, I will take your hands and lead you, like a big ship towing little boats. You are my care, I do not deny it." That last line, in recent weeks it has returned to me again and again. I sent it to a friend whose marriage is broken up, and I think of it as I walk my 16-month-old nephew down the stairs, his hands gripping my fingers. Heracles' words seem so gentle, rare, and tectonic, the acceptance of responsibility for another human. On this sunny but windy afternoon, I visited my Uncle Chris, who lives on a farm about an hour from ours. 50 years ago, he studied to be a painter, then had 4 children, and had to make a living and stop painting. He's in his late 70s now, and his wife died about 10 years ago. He paints in a converted shed surrounded by butternut trees. Wonderful, assured, mysterious paintings. He admires Rothko, Francis Bacon, Gerhard Richter. He won't sell his paintings. He hangs them in the house and then gives them away when he's tired of them. When I'm in Chris's presence, I always feel an immense optimism, which feels like a reminder of something I've forgotten. Chris has had his knees replaced and soon will have cataract surgery, and he paints away in his shed. The paintings change and develop. Now and then a solitary figure appears in them, usually in some sort of active tension with the field, at a run, blowing up a balloon, and in a recent one I saw this afternoon, on a swing, hair blown up and to the side, as if in a strong wind. My 75-year-old neighbor David, who made his living as a house painter, carves birds out of the wood from old cedar power poles, herons, ducks, sandpipers, eagles. 50 years ago, he adopted an orphaned young great horned owl and named him Owlick. A year later, Owlick crashed through a window in pursuit of a sparrow, never to be seen again, or so I'm told. So back to my fifth thought and Declan Donnellan's advice to the actor to prioritize paying attention over concentrating. David pays a lot of attention. The expectation of recording this thought 3 times a week has made me pay attention differently, or rather, it's forced me to reflect on what I have attended to, consciously or otherwise, and then to try and represent it, carve it somehow, into some form that looks like the original. But it never does, of course. It becomes something else. The act of shaping it always reveals something to me. Owlick paid attention, never gave up, and then, when his chance came, pow! Through the window.